Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to another edition of the Talking Metal Podcast, home of all things hard rock and heavy metal. I'm Mark Striegel, host and producer of this show since 2005. Now, let's get things started with the Talking Metal theme song, written by Rob Halford, Metal Mike, and Roy Z. Hey, this is Mark Striegel of Talking Metal. Welcome to another edition of the podcast. Special guest Greg Renoff is on the show with me. Greg, how are you?
Hey, thanks for having me back on.
Oh, thanks for coming back on. And you are here to discuss one of my favorite topics, Van Halen. You have an incredible book out, and I'm not just saying that to kiss your ass. I think it's just awesome. Van Halen Rising. It is now officially released. Last time you were on the show, it wasn't out yet. But it is now officially released, and we're going to talk about some of the stories in the book, and we're going to talk about Van Halen in general. Let's talk about your recent trip to ground, what would you call it? Is it ground zero? The place it all started, Pasadena, right?
Yeah, I would call it ground zero for sure. Over the last few months, two friends of mine, Janice and Roger and I, were sort of conspiring about doing this party out in Pasadena, and so we did that on Saturday night.
Was this like an official release party kind of?
Yeah. You know, what actually ended up happening is that the book actually came out a little bit earlier than we'd expected, so we had tried to time the book's release with the weekend closest to the date that we had from 6 months ago, and so it ended up being this weekend. But yeah, it was really a fun night. I'll tell you about the party, but on Friday night, what we did is... a few months ago, I had the opportunity to talk to Ted Templeman again, and I just floated the idea of him maybe coming to the book signing and signing some books with me at this bookstore called Vroman's Books in Pasadena. And Ted had lived in Pasadena in the late 70s when he was producing Van Halen, and he said, yeah, okay, I'll come.
Wow.
And, you know, you wait.
I saw
and
the
then
pictures.
It was pretty cool. And then you talk, you know, I talked to him about 3 weeks ago and confirmed, and he was coming, and I was like, all right, he's coming. And he did indeed come, and... sat at the table with me and answered questions from fans, and then we signed some books, and Ted signed all sorts of records and posters and all sorts of Van Halen memorabilia too. And it was just a really, for me, it was an incredible moment just as a fan. I mean, to have Ted Templeman in the room,
yeah,
answering questions from fans, which he's never done anything like that before.
Ted Templeman, that was amazing. Of course, the iconic producer who produced many different bands, but of course did those first six Van Halen records, as well as the first David Lee Roth full-length solo record. Did he do the EP too? I think he did, actually,
He did. He did the EP, and he also did he worked on For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge with Andy Johns. He was kind of brought in at the end, I think, to wrap the project up. They were sort of maybe doing a bit of drift there with trying to finish the songs and the record up, and so he came in for that one too. And yeah, he did, you know, Montrose and Carly Simon and Sinatra. Little Feet. Yeah, I mean, you just go down the line. It's like everyone you could possibly imagine. Eric Clapton. So it was, for me as a fan, obviously, I was just blown away to be in his presence, and then to be sitting with him and listening to him talk and answering questions alongside him was really just such an honor, and I could not possibly ever thank him enough. It was just amazing. And he said some things that we have a videos that are going to set to go up in the next couple of days on Van Halen News Desk. That'll be kind of episodes that everyone can see the whole Q&A and everything. So we did about an hour long Q&A, so we'll roll out these videos. But I said some surprising things, actually, things that I was actually surprised that he said publicly, that he had sort of, you know, said to me on the phone. It was not really meant for public consumption, but I guess he felt comfortable enough to say them, and talked a lot about just his whole experience with working with the band, and answered a ton of cool fan questions.
Now let me ask you, Van Halen Rising, the book, which is out now on Amazon. We'll have links up in today's show notes on talkingmetal.com. But what is there a publisher behind this? And if so, it's a smaller publisher, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a press called ECW Press. So they're out of Canada, out of Toronto, and they've done all of Neil Peart's books as well. So Neil's done a novel and a couple of travelogues, like books about his riding of motorcycles across the United States and across Canada. So yeah, it's interesting. You know, now that the book is out, I can kind of maybe tell just a quick snapshot of the story with how the book got published. I put together a book proposal and circulated it among some of the bigger presses. I mean, all the big presses got to see it. And, you know, I think there was a sense that because the Van Halen brothers hadn't endorsed it, and that David Lee Roth hadn't endorsed the book, meaning they hadn't, you know, they weren't writing it like Sammy wrote Red, you know, it was not their book. I think there was a little bit like, well, you know, we don't need to get involved with this because it's not going to do anything on the marketplace, and it won't be worth our time. And so, but, you know, God bless ECW Press, Jack David there and the rest of the people there saw the potential. I really tried to make the case, and to everybody that we talked to, all my agent and I talked to, that I thought the real interesting part of the story that had never been told were these years in Pasadena with the backyard parties and all of the setbacks and the Gene Simmons stuff. They believed in the project, and, they published the book.
Right. Cool. And, a couple things here. We're already kind of planning that this is part two of three with Greg. So we're going to definitely cover some of the Pasadena backyard party stuff and that era of the band, and the stories from the book. We encourage you to buy the book. But let's first, before we get into that, actually, I guess my question, going back to the publishing company, is honestly, how was the turnout at the launch party? You say there were fans there. It's not Simon and Schuster behind you. You don't have massive promotion. The guys in Van Halen aren't there. Did you get a good crowd? Were you happy with the turnout?
Yeah. So at the Friday night event with Templeman, we did about, there was probably about 130 people in the room.
That's great.
I've
That's
a great picture that there were people down the stairs trying to get into the room. And I said to them, it was funny, the woman who was running the event for the bookstore came up to me and said, "This is a really, really great crowd. We did really, really well tonight." And I said, Chelsea Clinton had been there two nights before. I said, "Did we do better than Chelsea?" She's like, "Do you want the truth?" I said, "Not really." She goes, "Yes, you did way better than Chelsea." So I didn't
Holy
do better
shit,
than Chelsea.
Really?
No, wow. She was joking. She was joking.
Okay.
She was joking. She was like, "No, you didn't do better than Chelsea." She's like, "Do you want the truth?" I was like, "No." She's like, But it was a really good crowd. And then the next night we had something like 180 people in the club. And so the club is called T Boyle's. It's a Pasadena bar, but it used to be called the Handlebar Saloon. And back in the '70s, Van Halen played there. And so we had bands playing like Van Halen, the tribute band, but we also had some of the other bands that were around a little bit after Van Halen in L.A. and Pasadena, one of them being Rampage, which is notable for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons they're notable is that Michael Anthony's brother Dennis was in that band and played bass in that band, and they played, and then we had a number of other guys from the scene who turned out and played. Terry Kilgore played a set, and Terry played with David Lee Roth and wrote a song with Rat and did some other things. He's been definitely a guy who's been around in the industry and was tight with Eddie in the early days. And so we had a great crowd. And then the big surprise being that Mark Stone, the bass player who was in the band before Michael Anthony, So that's back from, you know, 1971 to 1974. He was with the Van Halen brothers and played all the parties and did all the stuff with those guys for years. Practiced at Eddie's little house and over in Eddie Alice's little house over in Pasadena. He came up and played a song with the tribute band, which was pretty fun. And he was signing autographs for people and stuff. And I think it was a really special thing for him to get up there and have a little bit of fun.
Cool. Awesome. Congratulations on all the success. And again, it's congratulations on the book, because it really is a smooth read. It's a fun read. It's a lot of great stories. And some of the stories, in my opinion, even go outside of the whole Van Halen story. I mean, they all kind of tie in. But I wanted to start with just the amazing chapter about this family. And an Immler?
Exactly. The Immler family.
Immler family. I guess two girls, right? And yep. Was it Dennis was the 20, early 20-something who lived at home there. Ooh. And just through what was two parties, and the second party just turned into chaos. And the way, I mean, I think that chapter in your book, you got to write a screenplay just based on that chapter. I mean, it's such a great 70s era party story that I think could just, it would be so much fun to turn into a movie. But tell us a little bit about this family and about what happened at this party. And I mean, this wasn't the only party. It sounds like maybe it was the craziest one, but it sounds like there were a lot of crazy parties. Van Halen was a party band. They obviously, you explain in your book, had actually trouble breaking into the Hollywood scene, but in the burbs, in the outer communities in Los Angeles, they were the party band.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think, the way I would explain it is that it, you know, it's sort of like the was sort of the post Woodstock era. And I mean that, you know, that's what I think the character is, how would I put it? The kids who grew up in that era all knew about the big festivals, the Altamonts, the Woodstocks. You can go down the line, all these Monterey Pop, you know, all these big pop festivals. And I think that was sort of, you know, what they had seen as being a good time for you know, kids to go to. And they obviously couldn't rent a hall, but if you want to hire a band, you'd wait till your parents went out of town and you would hire these bands. And the Immler family lived in what would we consider an upper middle class,
right?
Subdivision. I drove through it the other day, and you know, the houses are big. And
are they still nice, or is it still or has it gone downhill since the 70s?
No, it's certainly, you can see that the houses were built in the 60s and 70s, and so it's not new construction, but there definitely are still a nice quiet. It's funny because it's a nice, quiet neighborhood with big trees that overhang the streets, and you could see how irritated people would be about these parties. And so the thing that they had these properties had going for them, that they had very large yards. They were in big, big, big lots. And so the Immler family, the three, it was Karen, Debbie, and her brother Dennis. The brother Dennis, they were all friendly with the Van Halens. And when the parents left town, they threw a party in the spring, and it went really, really well. It, you know, maybe 500 people in the yard or something like that, and it went well. And yeah, it was a little bit of a mess, but the neighbors didn't complain too much. And so when their parents left again to go back to Mexico, they decided to throw an even bigger party. And that's when
their parents would go away for a long time. We're talking like
right,
a month
right.
at a time.
Yeah, you know? Right, for like long periods of time. And the other thing that's really amusing about the story is that, you know, when I heard this, at first I thought you were kidding me. Debbie and Karen were kidding, but their father was actually a sheriff, a sergeant, I think, or a lieutenant in the sheriff's department. Actually, his specialty was juveniles and narcotics. So it's an absolute truth. And so they would leave, and they threw another party, and they hired Van Halen.
So the first party with Van Halen, a success. They get through the party. The second party, they, you know, in the first party, they tried to keep it a little on the down low.
Exactly.
Only 500 kids in the yard, you know, it's like, but this time they ramp it up a little bit, right? They start putting in flyers, they start spreading the word, and the word of mouth just spreads throughout Los Angeles County.
You know, the thing was that they wanted to throw a huge party. And so they paid and hired Van Halen. They built a little stage they rented. They had a spotlight that they put on top of the pool house. And they brought the flyers. I mean, the thing is, if you brought the flyers to enough high schools, kids would pass them around at lunch and stuff like that. And so, you know, what's going on tonight? This is before social media. You know, it was just a matter of word of mouth, and people just would pass the flyers around. And so they passed them. They told me they drove quite a ways outside of Pasadena and would go to these high schools and paste them up. And so you have you know, something like 3,000 kids descending on this property.
3,000 kids. That's insanity. I mean, like, I just saw Ghost sold out in Terminal 5, a club in New York. And, I mean, I think that's only, like, 2,000 people. And it was bodies just everywhere. You know, I can't – and that's in a club. I can't imagine 3,000 people in a property less than 2 acres, right?
Yeah, and so it was – I haven't seen the backyard personally, but I was able to drive along the side of it. And the backyard is very, very long and deep. I would estimate it's probably about the size of a football field. So it's big.
Okay.
You know, it's really big. It's, again, these lots are very big. And what ended up happening.
It's got to be a lot of money. That's got to, I mean, in Los Angeles, a piece of property that big, that's got to be, at least nowadays, a multi-million dollar place.
It's, yeah, I don't know. You know, it's one of these things where the house itself is not – it's certainly not something that would turn your head when you drove past it. But the size of the lot, yeah, the lots are – they're huge. The construction's a little bit older. And so what ended up happening was that the house bordered basically between Pasadena and what would have been considered an unincorporated part of Los Angeles. There's like a – there was a part of Pasadena that's sort of like on the edges there. And so what ended up happening that night is that the sheriff's department – the Temple City Sheriff's Department. So it's the LA Sheriff's Department, but they're based in Temple City, and they responded, and they were much more intolerant. In part because if you figure a lot of these kids from Pasadena were, you know, their parents. Some of them worked for the police department, and so there was much like, and I explained in the book, there was a lot more tolerance among the Pasadena police, where they would just say, "Dump out the beer and go home," or "You guys have 30 minutes to clear the property," and they would let them clear the property. Where these guys show up, they tell the one brother, Dennis, Van Halen's playing in the backyard. Backyard's packed. There's kids in the streets. There's cars everywhere. Traffic is slowed all around the property, and they tell the kid, they said, "You got to leave. You got to clear the property. You got to get everyone to leave." And so he attempted to do that. He went into the backyard and told David Lee Roth, as he told me, you know, he made his way to the stage. He said, "We got to stop it. It's over." And Dave ignored him. And so what he did is he pulled the power on the band. And when he went back out to tell the cops that he was going to clear the property, to kind of wake his way back to say, "Don't worry, I've told the band to stop playing." They plugged back in.
Alex, now, when he pulled the power, was it like a circuit breaker he was pulling, or he's just unplugging the band?
I think he was unplugging the band. I think he just like literally like pulled whatever they, however they had the power rigged, he was pulling the plugs out. And so he went back out to the front of the house, and you know, by the time he got back out, the band was playing again. And so basically Roth had decided they were going to ignore, they were going to play no matter what. They weren't going to stop. And so the cops were irritated about that. Then some kids started throwing bottles at the cop cars. And that's when the cops had to actually left because people were throwing things at them. And that's when the word went out that a riot had broken out on the property. And then the cops came in riot gear. So full on, you know, the helmets with the shields, the batons out, the whole nine yards.
Helicopters.
The tear gas, the whole thing. And they went on the property and were just pretty brutal. I mean, they were really brutal. And the paper says that 21 kids were arrested. I've been told by other people that there were a lot more kids than that are actually were arrested.
And at some point, water pipe breaks or something,
right? Right, yeah. Actually,
during this. You got police, you got 3,000 kids, you got police in riot gear. You have Van Halen playing at deafening volumes, and water start. What was that all about? Something about the line to the pool or something?
Yeah, actually, I got there's a picture on my Facebook page right now, my personal Facebook page, of meeting the guy who actually helped push back the water. There was a supply line to the pool, and so the cops storm into the backyard, and these kids are jumping over some of the kids were in the enclosure for the pool that had a little fence around it, and they were jumping the fence, the little chain link fence, trying to get away from the cops, and one of the kids fell or stepped on the supply line for the pool and broke the PVC pipe, and so the water. He broke it behind the valve, so all the water that had the pressure in there from the street started shooting out all over the place. And meanwhile, there's wires and
– and Eddie thinks it's going to maybe come towards the stage. So Eddie Van Halen is risking his life, potentially getting electrocuted, and is with a broom sweeping the water back from the stage.
Right? And this other guy, this guy I met who's on my Facebook page shaking his hand, they pushed the water back. And then Dennis had to run to the street and turn off the water at the main. And, you know, it was just absolute chaos. Their backyard was totally destroyed by the cops and the kids running, and you know, the cops just grabbing these kids and dragging them out, and it was violent.
And at some point, David Lee Roth, which seems to be a theme that he had back in these days when the parties would end with police coming in and interrupting and shutting things down is when they question him, he just was basically would take no responsibility. He's just like, I'm with the band, right? Which just sounds so
and that
Dave.
Was the party, that was the party that Michael Anthony told me that almost always worked without much problem. Like the cops would come up to them and they'd be like, hey man, you know, we just were told we're playing like a little, you know, a little birthday party or something. Right. I don't know what the hell happened here. And like, but the cops apparently Michael Anthony thought the cops were going to arrest him. He said, like, it didn't work, and the cops were really pissed, and they were going to arrest him, and it was just like just a miracle that the cops didn't cuff them. And he said, I was really scared. I thought we were definitely going to go to jail. The other funny thing about the story is, too, the cops go into the house, and they find – they're looking for the home – like, who owns the home? They're trying to find the homeowners, and so they find the sisters, and they say to them, you've got to get out of the house. They wanted to literally get every single person off the property. And they were like, we live here. And the cops were like, we don't care. And they had to argue and argue and argue. And eventually the cops said, okay, something like, you can stay and six people can stay, but everyone else has to leave. And so, from everything I was told, it was a brutal response by the police. It was no joke. They were, you know, pushing girls, knocking girls down, just clubbing people. And it was a big, full-on, like, police riot. They were just...
This is a riot in a suburban neighborhood, and... helicopters, at least one helicopter flying over top, just thousands and thousands of kids ended up on the news, right? In the papers, on the news.
Yeah, I have a newspaper article right here. I'm looking at it. Yeah, it was on the second page of the Star News, and it said something along the lines of, I'll pull it up. It's something like melee breaks out at, 21 arrested in Pasadena party melee. And it talks about, basically what ended up happening, which is that the cop showed up, said, hey, you guys got to tone it down. Then rocks and bottles were thrown, and then more and more people showed up, and then the cops just—that's when they stormed the property.
Does it mention Van Halen specifically in the article?
It doesn't. It just said there was a party in Pasadena, and then they said they talked about how they declared it an unlawful assembly, which was the classic phrase that they would use to say we now have the justification to arrest everyone on the property because it's an unlawful assembly.
Right on. A couple more little stories from the books that I want to hit upon. From this era of the band, pre-first record, the whole tapping thing. I mean, I was a guitar player back in the 80s, still am a guitar player, but we were, just so blown away by guys like Eddie Van Halen and Randy Rhoads and saw them as the innovators. But let's talk about Van Halen and the whole tapping thing. He brought it to the mainstream. But in the book, you attempt, and I think you successfully attempt, to trace back potentially where this all came from. And you mentioned a guy earlier, Terry, what was his? Something with a K.
Yeah, Terry Kilgore.
Kilgore. And now, can you talk about tracing it back to Terry and his friend then was it Terry that ended up taking lessons from the guy from Can you tell the story,
Yeah, I'll tell the story. So so in Pasadena in the early 70s, there were a lot of guitarists around and who were teenagers, but the two kids were the best were Eddie and this guy Terry Kilgore. And there was definitely a point in time where people said that Eddie and Terry were kind of neck and neck. I mean, I think everyone understands how great Eddie got and eventually became the best guitarist on the planet, and so they would spend a lot of time together, and they would sort of swap licks and talk about effects pedals, and in fact, in one of the guitar magazines, Guitar World in 2012, Eddie Van Halen gave Terry Kilgore props for introducing him to the phaser pedal, said that Terry Kilgore was the first guy I ever saw use a phaser pedal. And so what ends up happening is Terry Kilgore is giving lessons. So he's probably like 17 at the time. It's like 1974, 1975. And he's giving lessons at a music store. And one of his pupils is a guy named Chris Holmes. Chris Holmes is younger.
Right.
He is probably 14 or so. And
Chris Holmes, of course, most listeners know this, but went on to be a big part of Wasp in the early years.
Exactly. Pasadena guy. And so Chris had a summer job where he was painting houses, and he was outside of a house painting it in a near neighboring town. And when he looked in the windows, he saw all these gold records on the wall. And so he got up the nerve to knock on the door and asked the woman who was there, maybe she was the maid, maybe she was the wife, I'm not sure. She said, whose gold records are these? And she said, oh, it's Harvey Mandel. And Chris Holmes was like, huh, I don't know who that is. But he was excited to tell Terry, you know, the kind of the older kid who was the guitar teacher. And he said, I got to see Gold Records. They were on the wall of this house. And Terry said, who is it? And he said, Harvey Mandel. And Chris Holmes said, I don't know who that is. And Terry said, I know who that is. Go get his phone number next time you're up there. Get the phone number of the house. And so Harvey Mandel was a guitarist who was in Canned Heat. And he also did some solo records in the early 70s.
He played on stage at Woodstock, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so there was a guy who had taught Harvey Mandel the use of the secondhand tapping. And so when you listen to what Harvey Mandel does, it certainly – there are parts that might be slightly suggestive of what Eddie does. And I mean that in sort of like – you could sort of like take a reach and go, yeah, I could kind of see how that would be associated. But it was very different type of tapping. But there was – you know, he would do these little passages where you do this kind of meandering sort of stuttering tapping. Again,
but it's the whole idea that he was taking his right hand and applying pressure to the fretboard, which no one really did. Not a lot
exactly.
of people did
exactly.
at that point, which is something that Eddie became famous as the inventor of, if you
right.
will.
And so Kilgore goes up and takes some lessons from Harvey Mandel. He pays him for lessons. And so, you know, you can come back to your friend Eddie and go, hey, check this out, and showed him the two-handed, the tapping. And so it wasn't just me it wasn't just Terry who told me this. So Chris told me the story. There was also the sound guy who worked for Terry Kilgore at the time, who said, I actually sat in the basement, was working, you know, with the band, and I watched Terry showing Eddie this technique. And so a number of people saw this happening. And so what it was kind of interesting is that it doesn't seem like Eddie does a lot with the technique until later. So he doesn't really develop the full-blown – or I shouldn't say develop it. He doesn't really expose it to the world to pretty soon before Van Halen records their first record in 1977. So people told me that Eddie would do the sort of Beer Drinkers and Hellraisers type of tap. If you guys are listening, guitar players are sort of that one tap in there where you sort of reach over and you hit one note. It's like that in Kid Charlemagne. They said that Eddie would occasionally do that stuff. Eddie did that exact type of thing in Bottoms Up. If you listen to the Bottoms Up solo, it's sort of like a one tap in there. And so Eddie would do that occasionally, but he never did the sort of flowing two-handed stuff. Fast forward to 1977, one of the things that ends up happening is a guy named George Lynch, who I interviewed, is walking down the street in Hollywood, and he and Eddie are talking, and they're rivals, but they, you know, they're friends, but there certainly was, you know, there was a sense there was a rivalry there, but they got along, and they were walking past a club called the Starwood Club, and they look up, and there's this band, Canned Heat, who is reunited, and who is, and they say, featuring Harvey Mandel. And so George Lynch told me, this is like December 1976, that he and Eddie went into the Starwood Club together and watched Mandel do the tapping. Now, did that like re-spark Eddie's interest in it? I don't know. What I do know is that when you listen to bootlegs, by the summer of 1977, and if you talk to guys who are around, like Tracy G of Dio, who was around and saw this happen, he was a kid too, 17 years old, saw this happen, Eddie does the full-on eruption tapping. And this is right before Van Halen records its debut album in August 1977. And so, you know, whether Eddie was woodshedding it, playing with it, or whatever he did, you know, he worked it up. And I talked to Terry about that. He said, yeah, Eddie would take something, a technique, and just make it absolutely welded to his playing. And I want to be clear about something else, too. Terry's a really great guitar player. And Terry not once was trying to claim, like, I deserve the credit for this. He basically said, like, I showed Eddie this thing, and like he like ran with it a million miles beyond what I did. He's like, all I did was like just show him this thing.
But I guess the crazy thing, guys, if we think about this in a weird way, or Chris Holmes is maybe, possibly, most likely somehow he somehow provided Eddie this idea of tapping in a roundabout sort of way, right?
It's just a weird thing because, again, if
Chris Holmes didn't exist, maybe Eddie wouldn't have never tapped.
Who knows? The thing is, like, if Chris hadn't had hadn't been interested in trying to impress his guitar teacher, you know, that's why he went back and said, oh, I saw some gold records, because he knew that, you know, that Terry would be interested in that, and that's how that all ended up happening. You know, I think again, if you look around, there were other guys who were doing it. Like I said, Billy Gibbons was doing the one note tapping. I'm forgetting the guitarist's name, the guy who did the solo on Kid Charlemagne by Steely Dan. Larry Coryell, is that right? You know, so guys were doing it. And so I'm sure that Eddie heard those notes. Like I say in the book, like there's no way that Eddie listened to Beer Drinkers and Hellraisers by ZZ Top. I didn't hear the tap. This is a guy who would play everything, you know, could play solos note for note, could learn solos like that by ear. And so it's just a matter of that Eddie, maybe because of playing piano, maybe because he's just, you know, this musical guy that has a wholly different approach than a lot of people, just figured, I'm going to do something different with this. I'm not just going to do the sort of one finger stuff that other people are doing. I'm not going to do it like that. I'm going to make it into this thing that's basically these flowing streams of notes on the guitar neck to make it all sound totally different. And Eddie absolutely deserves 100% credit for inventing what we consider now to be two-handed tapping in the modern sense. Absolutely 100%.
Right on. Okay, real quickly, Ghazari. What was his first name? Was it Bill Ghazari?
Yeah, Bill Ghazari. Yeah.
Bill Ghazari, who, you know, we all saw along with Chris Holmes in The Decline of Western Civilization Part 2. And, you know, in my mind, as somebody who always dreamed of Hollywood and thought about the whole scene out there, this guy was a player. This guy was a cool guy. He was the older guy. He ran this cool club. He was, you know, Van Halen, all the great bands that I love played there. However, in reading your book, it sounds like this was kind of the dorky loser club of the Hollywood scene back in the 70s, as opposed to the cool kid club, which I kind of always imagined it. Did it turn into something cooler maybe later after Van Halen broke? And can you just, you know, for a minute or two, talk about Bill Ghazari and his club?
Sure, yeah.
Van Halen's relationship to it.
Yeah, I sort of like sketch it out as like a peaks and valleys. So if you imagine Ghazari has its heyday it's a club there in Hollywood on the Sunset Strip. It has its heyday, like 1968, 1969. You got the Doors, you got Buffalo Springfield, you have all these very, very big bands playing Ghazari's. But by 1974, when Van Halen gets in there, it's really like a club on the decline. It hasn't been remodeled in a long time. It's sort of a sketchy place. And there's a sense that bands that are playing there are not going to go anywhere. Ghazari's was a place where you could only really play cover songs. You might be able to slip in a couple of original songs, but it was not a place where you could showcase original material. And so for that reason, it was sort of seen as a dead end because, again, no record company executive is going to walk into a place like Ghazari's and say, oh, these guys just did a really kick-ass version of a Peter Frampton song. I'm going to sign them to a record deal and have them write songs. And so it was sort of a sense that it was not a very good platform for trying to get anywhere in the record industry. And that's one of the reasons why Van Halen eventually leaves Ghazari's and moves on to the Starwood Club, which was a higher level of club. Again, where you had to play original material. You might be able to play like one cover, maybe, but the idea was ZZ Top plays here. All the great bands of the era played there. You need to play original material. And then they eventually get to the Whiskey A Go-Go, which is an even sort of a slightly higher level playing club. So yeah, Ghazari was
Back to Ghazari's. I mean, it's, you know, the Van Halen, the legend of Ghazari says, oh, well, Van Halen was the house band here. I mean, that's one of the big stories I grew up knowing. But in reading your book, it sounds like maybe that wasn't at the time the most coveted place to be
it
the
wasn't.
House band.
It wasn't.
This was the club at that time, like you were saying, peaks and valleys. And maybe after Van Halen went on to explode suddenly, Ghazari's used that to become cool among the Motley Crues and the Rats and the bands that were breaking in the early 80s.
Yeah,
but in the mid 70s, this was not a cool place.
Absolutely. In the 80s, you sort of see that Ghazari sort of taps into something. You have the Warrants and these other bands playing there. So the later 80s, like Bill Ghazari really taps into that. But yeah, it was not considered to be a suitable platform for trying to get anywhere in the record industry. And so I tell a story in the book about a guy named Rodney Bingenheimer,
who was the mayor of the Sunset Strip.
Exactly. And so the story goes that he and a friend of his are in the Rainbow.
Now, he wasn't literally the mayor, guys. There's a documentary about him called The Mayor of Sunset Strip, which is a great watch. Everyone should watch.
Definitely. Yeah. So he was a scene maker and a guy who had an eye for talent. And he's in the Rainbow with a friend of his, and it's a boring night, and they're just walking. And they walk past this club, Ghazari's, and they'd never really been in there, you know, because it was considered a place for losers. It was just sort of like, you know, a place where like teenagers would go. Like you'd see 16-year-old teenagers with their braces drinking, you know, Cokes and watching these bands. And so they just on a lark, as Rodney's friend told me, they just went in there as a lark, and they see this cover band up there, Van Halen. And they just said they were so great doing these covers, and David Lee Roth is so engaging, and Eddie was such a great guitar player that even though they were playing covers, it sort of went against the grain with Ghazari's. Like they sort of like all of a sudden these guys are like, wow, this is really good. And they go up and they talk to Dave and Eddie, and they eventually convince them that they should try to get to the Starwood, and they do. And so Bill Ghazari eventually gets very pissed off about that. But Rodney Bingenheimer is able to get Van Halen an opportunity to play at the Starwood Club.
Yeah, which is wild because it was so long ago I saw the documentary on him, but I never really thought, you know, when you think of the people that really helped break Van Halen and move them along, you know, Gene Simmons, Ted Templeton, there's a lot of people there, but Rodney is not one of them that would have come to my mind. But in your book, it sounds like he really was crucial in giving them this this break that helped propel them to a higher level among the Hollywood bands and rock scene.
Yeah, I mean, I think he definitely opened the door. I mean, that's how I would describe a lot of these guys, like Marshall Burrell and Rodney Bingenheim. They opened doors for Van Halen. Basically, were like able to like open the door, and then those guys just were able to go through it and go on to the next thing and succeed. And even later on in 1976, when Van Halen comes back from New York, they have a demo tape that they've done with Gene Simmons. And even though Bill O'Coin has turned down Van Halen, and Van Halen is not able to do much of anything at all in the industry with that experience in New York.
Bill O'Coin, of course, the manager of Kiss, one of the biggest bands of the 70s.
Yeah, and so basically, you know, they come back and they're all disheartened about this because it's not going to get in. They don't think it's going to get them anywhere because they basically got rejected. But what does David Lee Roth do? He goes to Rodney Bingenheimer and says, "Hey, Rodney, I've got this tape." And they go on the radio, KROQ, big station in L.A. Rodney's a DJ, and they play "Running with the Devil" from the Gene Simmons demo. That's on YouTube. You can check it out. So, wow. You know, Rodney was the
when
guy
you say
who,
it's on YouTube, you mean the actual demo or the actual broadcast of
the broadcast? Where you
wow, I got to check that out. That's awesome.
Very, very smartly saying, giving Rodney Bingenheimer all the credit for things. We're bringing Gene into to see them and all this stuff. He's, you know, smart. And that was the first real radio airplay that Van Halen ever got. So they played
it's strange because David Lee Roth went on in his book to really seem to not like Gene Simmons.
Oh, we could talk about that on a whole episode, couldn't we? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to get into the next episode. We'll get into the Gene stuff. But so let's actually play a little music here. Why don't you pick a song to play off of? One of the songs they did on the most recent tour. Can you pick a song? There was a lot of them, but
yeah, I do "Dirty Movies." How about that?
You got it, "Dirty Movies."
Thank you.
Dirty Movies off the great Fair Warning record. Great, great record. Short record, every song, just fantastic. I love that record. Let's talk about the last tour. And at first, let's remind people the book, Van Halen Rising, How a Southern California Backyard Party Band Saved Heavy Metal. Excellent read. Guys, you got to pick it up. Let's flash forward many, many years to 2015. That's a song there that they played on the last tour. The tour is now over. Last show was what, Hollywood Bowl?
Yeah, in early October.
And they did this, I think maybe you tweeted out this clip of Roth kind of giving a farewell speech, if you will, tour farewell speech on the stage, which I listened to. And I got to tell you, when I listened to him talking about, you know, spent the best years of my life with this guy and talking about Eddie, and it's kind of touching and emotionally moved me as I've been listening to these guys, you know, since I was 11 years old, you know, a long, long time. But I afterwards, I really thought about what he said, and I started thinking, is this the end? Is this it? I mean, because those words almost sounded like a farewell, not just a tour farewell. Could this possibly be it? Is that maybe the last show we'll see with those guys on stage together?
I think, you know, you never say never with Van Halen. I mean, as we know from the history, that the craziest things can happen, and you just can't believe that that's actually, you know, they reunited with Roth, they reunited with Hagar. The thing that really stuck out to me, along with that speech, which is really important, I think, to think about what Ross said, is that Wolfie tweeted out, went on Instagram and Twitter, maybe what about a month and a half earlier, saying he had a clip of him playing drums. Great drummer, by the way. That's his first instrument, believe it or not. And then he said, I can't wait to get back to work on my own project. You know, that to me suggests that Wolfie maybe was trying to just kind of put the word out there that, you know, that I put everything on hold, my record, the Wolfgang Van Halen project, whatever it's going to be called, to go on the road with Van Halen, and I'm happy to do that, but I'm going to go back to it. And so there's that. You know, do you just put a record out and not tour behind it? I find that difficult to believe that Wolfie would just want to throw a record out there in the world and then not want to play some shows with a band. And so to me, that suggests that maybe there's going to be a period of quiet coming in Van Halen, at least from the, you know, the core Van Halen band. And the other thing too is that, you know, what do they do next? I guess that's what I would say. And I ask you to answer it too. It's like, what do they do next? They put out the live album. They were not able to record a new album in the 2 years or so that they had between Different Kind of Truth and the Tokyo Dome. They didn't record a new album. As far as we know, there were no sessions. I think we would have had an inkling if there were really recording sessions going on. Someone would have leaked that. There's no recording sessions. Far as I know, Dave doesn't go to 5150, doesn't go up there. And so, what are they going to do next? Are they going to suddenly decide to record a new record? I find that hard to imagine, considering they had 2 years to do it and they didn't.
Yeah, and I mean, the other question is, you know, in certain markets, the tour did do good and pulled in a lot of people. In other markets, it struggled and had some issues. You know, so you have to wonder, you know, if promoters are going to be willing to put up whatever the band needs to go back out on tour. I mean, U2 on their last tour, I mean, it was a record, but they were making $8 million a night. You know, it's said that Guns N' Roses, if they get Slash, Axl, and Duff all on the stage together again, that maybe they could do something close to that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think, even if you pull Michael Anthony back in, I don't think Van Halen could get close to that, you know, in 2 years' time. I don't know. I really don't know. It should be interesting. I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, again, I think the next obvious move that everyone would want would be a record, or even, you know, like I said to someone the other day, like even an old school 45, like two songs, like just put out two songs and make them really good, but put them out. I think the fact that there's no new music forthcoming, I think, kind of lets everyone think, well, what's next? What are you going to play next year that's going to get people excited? You played the deep cuts and you've played the greatest hits and you've done these things. It's sort of, what do you do next?
Yeah. Huh. I don't know. It's a good question. Good question. I guess we'll have to wait and see. And is there any scenario you see in your mind that could keep Dave and Eddie working together and, you know, get them either putting out new music or playing more shows?
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, I think the thing is the money. Like you said, I think the money is so important now with these types of tours. And I just think it's going to be challenging going forward because
would they do a festival type package deal? You think? Like,
look, yeah.
I mean, I saw Def Leppard, Styx, and Tesla, and you know I live in New Jersey, and a shitload of people live here, but there were 18,000 people there. I mean, it was absolutely insane and fun and great, and there's something that adds to the excitement when you have those types of crowds.
I think, for example, like you know. I think it would make it would it would.
Why did they take Kenny Wayne Shepherd out in the road?
I got a lot of things to say about this. So here's the thing.
No,
it's fine. I just think I'm like nodding my head agreeing because I think the same things. I think first of all, Kenny Wayne Shepherd's a great guitar player, right? We know that
absolutely. But they need a package deal. They need somebody who's going to help bring in people.
I think that Eddie and Alex have traditionally shied away from that because they want. I think they want the Van Halen name to stand on its own, meaning that they want to stand on their own 2 feet and say, we drew the crowd. We did this. We did that. Not for ego, I don't think, but just because they have pride in their band and they think that if you slip to that level, somehow they're slipping below, like, you know, they're slipping down to a different level. That said, can you imagine how fun it would be to see Van Halen and Kiss on the same bill? You know, right. Like if they did it the right way, where, you know, Eddie and Gene did interviews, you know, imagine that, like they sat down and they talked about what it was like to work together in the early days. I think they could do really, really good business and it would be really fun.
Yeah. And people would, you know, Michael Anthony or not, people would come to the show. I mean, I think there's a lot of possibilities for that, you know?
But the thing is they've always, even since the reunion with Roth, Kamani Marley, you kind of go through the opening acts. They're not, it's almost say to people, if you're in the house,
right? Where are the Commodores?
Cool in the Gang.
If
you're in the house, you're almost 99% sure to be there because of Van Halen. You know, right. Cool in the Gang, as we know, classic band, great band. I'd like to see them maybe one day, but I didn't want to see them opening for Van Halen.
Right.
You know, but the guys in Van Halen, for whatever reason, and we can be sure that Eddie and Alex are calling most of the shots these days. It's just, I think, the way the power structure now in the band is that, you know, those guys are sort of the decision makers just don't seem to be interested in that. And again, I'm as puzzled as you are as why they don't think bringing
because
out.
Eddie, out of all people in the band, seemed to embrace more of the hard rock bands. I mean, Roth, you know, was more the dance guy and still is apparently, you know, talking about Nicki Minaj and whatnot. But you'd think Eddie, who shows up at Dimebag's funeral and, you know, loves Black Sabbath and stuff like that. I mean, you know, I know Sabbath's wrapping it up, but like an Ozzy Van Halen tour would do really well, you know?
Sure. I mean, like even imagine Black Sabbath Van Halen, like a double headlining thing. I mean, people would go crazy for that. I mean, that would be the thing that would really allow them to go out on the road and I think make better money than they probably made this time around. Just from the merch and just from the generated the excitement. And so I just think that Eddie and Alex think the way they think and they think our band has to be the draw because that's who we are. We're Van Halen. And so, you know, as you said, there were probably some very soft ticket sales in some markets. They did better in others. They certainly in Hollywood, I know, is packed out completely.
Right, yeah.
But you know, we all talked about the Groupon sales and stuff. I mean, I don't think the tour did the business that the promoters had hoped. And so to have it now be where, what do you do next to get people to come? You can't just say we're going to play greatest hits again, I don't think, because people are going to be like, well, I saw them last summer. I don't know. And, you know, certainly the core fan group will come out, but I don't think you're going to get that beyond the core 8,000, 10,000 people who are going to come out anyway to really get that, like that juice for the tour.
Right, right on. Okay, a couple quick questions before we wrap things up. On the tour, it seems like numerous times, maybe it was only one time, I think it was numerous times, Dave looked over at Wolfgang before Ice Cream Man. Wolfgang's obviously not the typical, you know, stick thin rock star, and said, "You look like you like ice cream." At least I've been told that's what he said. I mean, is this a diss? I mean, what, the guy's obviously a little, you know, on the pudgy side. I mean, I don't know. Is this just good, clean joking around, you know, Dave, or is this kind of passive aggressive?
You know, it's funny you say that. I have a pet theory that no one seems to buy, but you know, at times, as you and your listeners know, Roth kind of goes off script where he seems to just, you know, not really focus on singing the songs, kind of mumbles through things, does these little stories and these raps, and seems to be wanting to sort of just, I don't know, just say, I'm going to call the shots. And I almost wonder if it is sort of passive aggressive. You know, maybe he and Eddie aren't getting along particularly well at a tour stop, and he decides that I'm going to do whatever the hell I want to do tonight, and those guys are going to have to deal with it. I don't know. I mean, it's the dynamics of the whole Van Halen Roth relationship is very hard to puzzle out. Obviously,
yeah. I mean, do you agree with what Hagar has said recently about there being no chemistry on stage? I mean, have you witnessed that?
I don't know if there's no chemistry on stage. I think they have their moments together.
I didn't feel that. You know, from
no, I think there was. I think there was no chemistry on stage in 2004 when Hagar wasn't. You know, was basically staying to one side of the stage and Eddie was drunk out of his mind or on drugs. I mean, that was when there was like insane no chemistry. I mean, but
right.
You know, I think I do know for a fact, like a lot of bands, Roth and the three Van Halens travel separately. There actually isn't even a presence for Dave backstage, from what I understand. Not because, from my understanding, the Van Halens are keeping him out, that just that Dave has chosen to sort of not make himself visible in that sort of way. And so what does that mean? Does it just mean that those guys have all decided that for just to keep the peace, that it's just better if they keep their, you know, distance between each other, and that, you know, they get along okay, but it's sort of like the uncle that you have trouble with. You see him and you say hello to him, and then you just think it's probably best to keep your distance. It's hard to know because those guys don't do interviews either. I mean, how right. bizarre is it that David Lee Roth let his URL lapse? DavidLeeRoth.com, he let it lapse, gets rid of his Twitter, gets rid of his Facebook. I mean, that's just beyond comprehension. The guy who could never turn down an interview, now you can't get him to talk on a microphone. He absolutely hasn't done it. Think about it. He hasn't been on front of an interview for a microphone in months. I can't remember the last one he's done. So it's very strange.
Why do you
strange.
Think that is? Do you think that is because he doesn't want to be asked about the future of the band? He doesn't want to be have to be put on the spot as to what's going to happen after the tour
or ticket sales are down? It's very –
Usually, Slash has canceled all upcoming interviews, and that's made the Guns N' Roses reunion rumors even ramp up more.
Sure.
You know, it does seem like a lot of times. I mean, sure, you got guys like Prince who never do interviews, but yeah, like you said, a guy like Slash is talks to freaking everybody. David Lee Roth loves doing interviews. It's like, why? Yeah, you got to wonder.
Think about it. You could do email interviews and say, I'm only answering these five questions, and you can feel free to ask them, and that's it. So he doesn't even do those. So like, I understand maybe you don't want a microphone shoved in your face at a radio station where someone's going to ask something, you know, do you and Eddie hate each other or something, and, you know, kind of go off script. But yeah, you could do, you know, emails by interview and just say, these are the ones I'll answer. If you ask me anything else, I'm just not going to answer it. And this is what you get. And listen, Rolling Stone, everyone would be lining up for those interviews, obviously. And so, I don't know. It's also kind of bizarre because if you think about 2012, what we had is that Roth did tons of promotion. He was the guy, when they released Different Kind of Truth, who kind of was the most focused on promoting. And so for him to sort of say, I'm not going to say a word, like I said, I don't know. It's just, it's very strange. You almost wonder if it's sort of a, you know, part of their agreement that, you know, Eddie doesn't want Dave talking to the press. Again, I'm just speculating. I don't know. It's because it's so different than the way he used to be.
Right.
It's hard for me to comprehend why he would not do that. Because especially because if you thought about it, if you went to town and you did a 3-minute interview on the radio like the old days or whatever, it's like, you know, it might help juice some sales for tickets. It's, you know, probably isn't going to make a huge difference. But, you know, you get on the radio, David Lee Roth, and someone goes, oh, I didn't know Van Halen was coming to town. I love them. And you go buy a lawn seat, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Last question. Randy Rhoads, another iconic guitar player from, you know, Southern California area. You look at the two records he put out with Quiet Riot before, you know, long before, 5 years before Metal Health was a hit. The Japan only releases. I look at bootleg clips of Randy Rhoads, and it seems like his playing style to me drastically changed after the release of that first Van Halen record. Now, I've had people tell me, oh, well, he was on fire before that. He was, you know, him and Eddie, they were the two kings of Southern California as far as unsigned guitar heroes go. I just don't see that. I don't know. I really feel that he was good, and he was – if you look at some of the very late bootlegged Quiet Riot footage, there's a video. He was getting good, but he just – there was something – and I've heard this story that after that first Van Halen record came out, he just stayed in his room for 12 hours a day and practiced his ass off until he was up almost to the Van Halen level. Some people say he was up to the Van Halen level. But do you think it's safe to say that Eddie was a tremendous influence on Randy Rhoads?
Well, I mean, yeah, I really am glad you asked this question because I've never had really a chance to talk about it, and I want to talk about it at length. I think that if you listen to the solo, you know, on Tribute, I mean, that's obviously an Eddie Van Halen influenced his individual solo that Randy does.
Yeah.
You know, I think.
The solos to, you know, Crazy Train and Flying High Again.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
I mean, iconic Randy solos, and I love Randy, and I think he was such a unique player, and he did bring a certain element to his playing that Van Halen didn't have, with some of the classical influences and stuff were a little more prominent, a lot more prominent. But the finger tapping, he was like the kind of second guy to take the torch that Eddie Van Halen lit and carry it on. And I hear people will argue with me on this show. They'll argue with me that no, you're mistaken. Randy Rhoads was actually simultaneously doing this and along with Eddie, and that Eddie wasn't that big of an influence. And I have not seen that evidence.
I don't think that's yet. I don't think those people are correct, and all due respect to them. I think what you look at Randy in 1977, Randy was a guy who was very influenced by Mick Ronson, right? Very, you know, the Les Paul, the polka dots, the bow tie, the whole nine yards.
They were a great player in 1977.
Sure, a great player.
Not what he became in late 1979 or early 1980.
Not a jaw-dropping player. And so the other thing I want people to understand, and this is really important, is that Randy Rhoads was one of a number of guys who were really good guitar players at the time. Who was playing on the scene at the time? Rusty Anderson, who's now Paul McCartney's guitar player. He's a great guitar player, right?
Again, who you talk about in the book.
Right. Let's go down the line. Tommy Gervin, who now plays with Eddie Money, was playing in a band called Smile, great guitar player. Randy Rhoads, George Lynch, great guitar player. A guy named Jimmy Bates, who's dead. Jimmy Bates played a Charvel upside down, strung upside down. He looked sort of like, with all respect to Jimmy Bates, God rest his soul, I never met the guy. He had died a few years ago. Looked sort of like Ben Franklin. You know, he was not the cute Eddie Van Halen Smile, Randy Rhoads. He was not a pinup looking guy. And so, you know, he was like this big hulking guy. Tracy G of Dio. Right. All these other guys who were around at the time, Mark Kendall, ask Mark Kendall of Great White. He'll tell you this guy was an absolute beast. He said he just absolutely shredded. And again, there were a lot of great guys on the scene. And so Randy, to me, peaks in 1980, 1981, just like Eddie peaked in 1977. Eddie Van Halen is a guitar player. He was an amazing guitar player in 1975. But when you have the whammy bar and the tapping and the whole end of the world sort of apocalyptic stuff he does with Eruption, that all sort of comes together for him in 1977. So Randy sort of hits his moment in 1980. That's not any offense to Randy. It's just a matter of guys develop a style, and sometimes they sort of hit a peak at a certain time, and that's when Randy hit his peak. And so, yeah, I mean, I think to say that Eddie and Randy were neck and neck is untrue. It just is untrue, and I know that offends people.
There are people that say it, though, and well, I understand that, you know, Randy died so tragically and that you know people want to defend him, and
if Randy
think that Eddie's arrival on the scene really probably rattled Randy and caused him, pushed him to become the monster, the great player that he became a few years later.
I think that's right. I mean, the thing is, if Randy was doing all that stuff, why didn't he do it on the Quiet Riot records?
Yeah, and I mean the whole thing with the tapping and stuff too, which you talk about in your book, that Eddie really didn't really release this publicly, at least until right before the first record.
Correct.
There's no way. I just don't think anyone was doing that, at least not like Eddie was before that. You know,
and here, a challenge to your listeners: go find Tracy G on Facebook. He's there. Ask him; he'll tell you. Ask Mark Kendall. These guys were around. They saw it. That's why I interviewed these guys. This isn't me just making it up, like inventing it out of thin air. I interviewed guys. I tried to find guys who were pro guitar players who were trying to get good at the time and were obsessed with the guitar, and asked them to tell me what they thought. And what they will tell you is that, again, Eddie develops all that sort of stuff late in the game. It's late. It's not in 1975. It's 1977, the whammy bar. Tracy G told me. He said he couldn't believe it the first time he saw it. No one could use a Strat like that on the local scene. You'd hit the Strat bar, the, you know, the Fender Strat, like Eddie did without the locking nut at the end of the neck, and it would go out of tune. Eddie was doing these monster dive bombs, and it wasn't going out of tune. And, you know, Tracy would be like, my God. Next thing you see 3 days, you know, 3 weeks later, the tapping comes out. And it's just like, you're the king, man. You're the king. That's it. And that was always – I even asked guys like Tommy Gerben to be provocative and to ask them about other guitar players. And he actually got irritated with me. He was like, what are you talking about, man? He's like, Eddie was the guy. He said, George was great. Randy was great. He kind of went through these guys are all great players. It's not knocking them. It's just like there's a guy who was superior. It's just the way it is. It's like Michael Jordan. It's like it doesn't mean that other guys who were playing basketballs were all-stars, weren't amazing. It's just Michael Jordan was the guy. And right. to sort of say like, oh, you know, someone else because they died is better than Michael Jordan is just not true.
Right. Right on. Great stuff. Eddie Van Halen, the absolute master of the sixth string. And Greg, thank you for writing this book, Van Halen Rising. It is just a great, great read that all the Talking Metal listeners need to go pick up. It's on Amazon, I'm sure. We'll have it linked through today's show notes. And where's the best place that the listeners can get in touch with you online?
Yeah, it's swing by vanhalenrising.com. You go there. I actually have you can sign up for the email list there. I've also have some t-shirts I'm going to roll out of the book cover and stuff. They're really kind of cool. So if you're interested in that, be happy to do that. And last thing I'd say is that if you want a signed copy, Van Halen store has them in stock. So just go to the Van Halen store and they have author signed copies, not signed by Eddie and Alex, by the way. Someone's like, are they signed by Eddie and Alex? I'm like, right. No, it's me. It's an author signed book. It's not a, right. not a Van Halen signed book. So happy to connect with people on Twitter as well at Greg Renoff, and yeah, hit me up. And oh, hey, always a pleasure, Mark. I really like talking to you.
Hey, it's great. It's great fun. I could talk about Van Halen all night, and we will hopefully have you back in a month or two. We'll do another episode. Guys, support Talking Metal by using our Amazon links on talkingmetal.com. Go check out the show notes for today's episode in the Talking Metal section of talkingmetal.com. Listen to One-on-One with Mitch LaFon. Listen to Metal Rap, some of my other shows, and also leave a PayPal donation if you want to support what we do here on the podcast. The PayPal tab is again on talkingmetal.com. Thanks, Greg. And yeah, let's do it. Let's, you know, a month or two down the road, let's bring you back and we'll talk about Gene Simmons and Ted Templeton and all that fun stuff.
Awesome.
Cool.
Reasons, what's the lie? Cause I ain't leaving. We're in for a very long night. Heard a vicious rumor from your mama's tongue. You a desperate woman, need a man with a gun. High crime zone in the city of lights. Say the please.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.